Hey guys, welcome to Unpacking Design. I'm Mike LaValle.
And Tim Ung, and this is a show where we tell you about products and ideas that relate to designers all over the world. Hey guys, welcome back to Unpacking Design. Today's topic is one that I've been wanting to do for a very long time, but I've been hesitant to do it.
Uh-oh.
So today, Mike, we're going to be unpacking the ideal client for a designer.
Okay.
And I think this is a very good topic because I don't know about you, but I've been in face-to-face contact with multiple kinds of clients in my career so far as an architect. And I'm sure down the line I'm going to have a lot more of these interactions, right?
Sure.
So when you think of an ideal client, we're architects, which is similar to other designers as well.
Sure.
You're eventually going to have a client come up to you and say, hey, I want you to design X for me.
Yep.
Right? In your mind, what is an ideal client for you? Like, what kind of a person would you want, or a company would you want, to come up to you and ask you to design something for them? You're about to go through this, actually.
Yeah, with the website design.
Yeah.
Freelancing. So I thought about this a lot, and actually because I'm about to go through this, I've been thinking about this a lot lately because it's something that I'm looking for. I feel like if you're, especially when you're starting out with a service business, you have to be aware of like the right fit, sort of. So like I'm looking for the perfect client would be somebody who is open to the process, somebody who can make decisions fairly quickly or easily, someone who actually has the ability to pay me, and probably somebody who is fun and or easygoing. So I think if those are, honestly, those are kind of the four factors I would say. I would say open to the process, interested in the design process in general, or whatever, the creative process, whatever. Easygoing, can pay me, and I can't remember what the last one was. Easygoing, pay, and can make decisions.
Yeah.
It's funny, that's the one I forgot. I think those are things that I've learned to be important because I've experienced problems on all four of those before, and it's been, depending on which one it is and depending on how long the problem festers, it becomes problematic to continue a relationship with that client. Because if, for example, let's take it from the opposite end. So like if they aren't willing to be part of the creative process, it becomes very difficult to present anything to them. It becomes very difficult to then get feedback from them because they're not open to the process in the first place. Or maybe they just want to have, an example might be if you're an architect and they just want you to, as licensed professionals, we stamp and sign our drawings so that they become legal documents for construction. If somebody just wants you to sign and stamp the drawings that they've brought to you and you have no input on what the drawings are and you're putting your license and your credibility and your professional liability on the line, that's kind of an awkward position for you to be in as the creative professional because somebody's just dropping a bunch of drawings on your desk and saying, hey, just stamp these. That's all you got to do. That's what you're here for. It's like, well, that's not really what I'm here for. If they can't pay you, then it becomes really difficult to be in business or have a business at all or provide for yourself or the people that work with you or whatever.
Right.
And if you, I think easygoing is actually sort of a factor that people don't necessarily consider. But if you can't, I don't think it has to be something where you're completely compatible with somebody. But if you can't sit down and have a conversation with somebody not related to the work that you're doing and just have an interest in sort of their lives or like the thing that somebody told me once is like, you know, they want to have one of my old bosses said that like you really want to work with somebody that you can go have a beer with.
Yeah.
You know, that you can sit down and have a conversation, have dinner with or, you know, that's a lot of times that's why people will take other people golfing. you know, or take somebody to a sports game, you know, as a person who owns a business and has a service business with other clients. You know, they'll bring clients to foster those relationships, because if they can have that relationship outside of the professional service, it makes it easier to have the professional service be something that's viable.
Yeah.
So I think those are the first four things that come to mind are those four, because if those are all working, most of the time the problems that need to get worked out can get worked out.
Yeah. I agree. I think for me, the ideal client is probably going to be a client that allows me to have the design freedom, right? And doesn't take on the role of trying to be a designer or an architect during that relationship. And what I mean by that is it'd be ideal to have someone that came up to me with like some ideas of what they're looking for, right?
Absolutely.
And then they're like, hey, this is what I'm looking for. These are some of the ideas I've had. This is the kind of material that I like. This is, you know, at least some background research in some minor way, just to give you some context to start in. And then obviously for me, I think it's always a good thing for us as designers to lay out what that process is going to look like for the client. That way they understand this is how it's going to happen from here moving forward.
Sure.
This is what I'm going to provide you at these intervals and is what I expect in return. And once you do that, the next expectation of me is having trust between the client and myself. Right? So if I made a design decision, having the owner in this case, or the client, trust that decision and understand why I'm trying to make it. And even if they don't have a full understanding, they question it and they like, let me explain myself. Yep. In lieu of saying, no, that doesn't make sense. I don't want a column here, but I don't want to pay more money, right? It's like when you start having people who are asking for something that can't be done because they saw it on TV somewhere, it's, to me, that's where it gets very tricky. You know, when you have someone trying to negotiate for something that's dangerous.
Yep.
Or when you have someone asking for something that really can't be done in their budget. And for me, it's someone that's practical, someone that's like down to earth and kind of binary in a sense. Like I like people who have creativity and want a lot out of their project. But I think for me, having an ideal client is having one that can also understand some things really can't be done for a budget that they set.
Sure.
And yeah, I'd say an ideal client is someone who doesn't have a budget.
Yeah.
Right. But at the end of the day, I think having constraints also helps a project too.
Yeah.
So having a client who knows how to provide the constraints and who can also work within them alongside of me.
I think that those are really great points. I think the trust one is a really big one. And that makes me immediately think of let's say, for example, your client is actually more than one person.
Yeah.
Having one of the people designated as the decision maker, because you can have trust that, like, for example, if we work with a lot of schools, public schools, in my 9-to-5 job.
Yeah.
And there's usually a triangle of power that happens at each school district.
Right.
There's a facilities person who's the director of facilities for all the school maintenance at all the buildings. There's a business official who takes care of all the money and the business operations. And there's a superintendent who sort of oversees the functioning and the quality of everything at all the schools all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think each one of those people always brings their own expertise from their own factor in the sort of overall, whatever their job is, right? And typically the one that's making the decision is the superintendent, but sometimes there might be a reason why another person makes the decision, or maybe they have to bring in somebody else because there's another person who has to make a decision. And I think the situations that work the best are when somebody takes charge and somebody says, of the group, I'm going to be the person who is going to sort of make the decisions. Doesn't always have to be the one person you think it is, but it has to be one person who says, I'm going to sign off on whatever these things are. Because I think where it can get a little bit fuzzy is when no one wants to make a decision, and then you're left, okay, well, you could do this or you could do that. What do you want to do?
Right.
when somebody is there making a decision, you trust that the process is working itself out naturally, mm-hmm. because you are, they might not always be making the correct decision in your mind, mm-hmm. but they're making a decision to propel the project forward.
Right.
You know, and I think that's important because, you know, a client isn't always going to be the one person. It's going to be, it could be a group of people that all are stakeholders in whatever the project is. It could be, you know, it doesn't even have to, we're talking about architecture a little bit, but it could be, let's say with this website design business that I'm starting, mm-hmm. that I'm working with, you know, a couple who has a business that they're starting and they want a website for it, mm-hmm. you know. One of the two in the partnership might say, oh, well, I really want this to be red, or mm-hmm. I want this to flow this way on this page, or yeah. I want this thing to be this thing. But at the end of the day, one of them has to make the decisions to mm-hmm. make the process easier. Otherwise, it fractures the decision making and it fractures the process.
Right.
I think that's important because if you start looking at a project in too many different ways, you start to lose the trust that it's working.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a different kind of trust, mm-hmm. But I think that level of connection that you have with a client is important because yeah. otherwise it just kind of flounders or it sits there.
Yeah, I think those are all really good points, especially now that we are scaling up, right? So yeah. basically, if you had one ideal client, we talked about what we would want there.
Yep.
As you get into the corporate levels, that's where I think it changes. Like, we still want the same things, but at a corporate level is where I found a lot of challenges.
Yeah.
And for me, it's a little different than for you because I'm at a point where I'm working on a product that has a client who then has their own client,
right.
who then is also the decision maker.
Right.
And so in order to get a decision made, it has to pass through the triangle of the first client.
Yep.
Then it has to pass through the triangle between that client and the next client of theirs.
Yep.
And once it gets that okay, it has to work its way back. And I think this is where I would say an ideal client in this sense would be one where the flow of communication is very clear. There's far too often so many decisions being made within each triangle that by the time it works its way back to us as a designer, we get the wrong information.
Yep.
And then when we design it and it works its way back up that chain again, it's the wrong thing or it wasn't what they looked for. And it's because certain people want to look better because they can save money. And when they relay the information back to us as a designer, they tell us the wrong thing.
Sure. And it's not even intentional always. It's right. like the game telephone where you have like 8 people at the end of the line.
That's right.
The 8th person isn't going to necessarily know what the first person really said.
Yeah. And that's why I think having an ideal client that has that open line of communication within that triangle,
yep.
the bigger triangle, the delta, I guess, is critical because when we design, we need that information. It's not like you get a design, you get an answer back, and then your design only takes 10 minutes.
Sure.
Right? And that's the other thing, too. An ideal client is one that understands that design doesn't happen immediately. And I think that's one we have to point out because yep. I sat at a meeting with the client and the owner, and at this one meeting, there was something said about drafting something for a project, right?
Yep.
And it's, let's say it's like 2,000 square feet. And the expectation was that the drafting can be done within 2 hours.
Wow. Okay.
And the first thing that came to my mind was, well, that's not realistic. And so I explained why it wasn't realistic. And the reason why it was believed to be realistic is because the client and the owner don't have an understanding of the technology we're using.
Right.
Their assumption is, well, we've gone far from hand drafting and hand drawing to a point where now the computer makes everything, it just does it for us. And that's what they said. Well, it just does it for you, so why can't you get it done? And that's the client that you wouldn't want.
Right.
Someone who has these unrealistic expectations of what technology can do today. It's kind of like the recent, we're doing this recording in mid-December 2018.
Yep.
And, you know, last week, there was the Senate review with Google where you can tell that none of the people on a committee or a handful of them understood
sure.
what actually happens through a search engine, through technology.
Yep.
And when you listen to the questions that came up during that Senate hearing, it's kind of what I went through that day with the technology battle of what can we realistically draw and draft within X amount of time.
Right.
And it was the fact that they had a belief that there's algorithms out there where the programs we use will just design their project. If we just input, the owner wants this. All of a sudden, a 10,000 square foot space is fully designed and optimized for this client, right? So there's that level of it too, where we need to do a better job as the designer to explain how things actually work and operate and explain how we can be more efficient so that they can save more time and money for their project.
I think their reaction is important too. So like I could deal with, for example, somebody not understanding the process, but as long as they were able to accept what the process was,
right,
that would be okay with me on some level. Like I wouldn't want to explain it every single time, but to some degree, unless you're in it, you don't know that life. You don't know what that really is like. You know, if you're not a creator inherently or a designer, you don't necessarily know what the parameters are that you deal with every day. You know, you might be use this analogy a lot today, but you might be a chef. And you know, it even though you're making these different recipes and you're creating these different meals, you might not necessarily know how somebody can create a painting or a layout a newspaper design layout or write a book or, you know, I mean, like everybody has their own specialties. And the thing that I try to keep in mind is that as long as the person on the other end can respect the process and that as a professional, whether it's a designer or architect or whoever, creative, that I know more about my thing than they do, and they know more about their thing than I do.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good term for it. And that's probably at the highest of my list for the ideal client, a client that has mutual respect.
Yeah.
And it's because if I'm designing for a doctor, right, and I'm designing a hospital for them, I would expect them to see me in the same light where I know what I'm designing. And if I'm recommending something, I'm not doing it for my own benefit.
Right.
I'm recommending it because it'll benefit them.
Yep.
And at the end of the day, I think all designers have some analogy close to this, where we always think if we were doctors and we had an ideal client, the ideal client would never come back to us and say, why are you prescribing this medicine for me? You know, I don't want to take this medicine.
Right.
Right. The moment you're sick and you're looking for a solution and the doctor says, well, you can take Advil, and they prescribe you Advil or Tylenol or whatever for painkillers, you're just like, okay, I'll take it.
Right.
But when it comes to us, there's always lashback. It's always, well, no, why don't you move a line 3 pixels to the right? Or no, I don't like this color. What other color of blue can you give me? And there's like millions of hues of blue. And it's, you know, like there are certain times when I think people need to step back as a client and say, well, realistically, what am I asking of this person and of this firm?
So I think there's a building on that. There's a level of empathy that I would want in an ideal client. So for example, the website that I created for a friend recently that sort of put me on this path to want to make a freelancing web design business.
Yeah.
He is himself an architect who struggles with trying to provide services at a reasonable cost for what they're worth. So he immediately understood what I was asking for in return for my own services.
Right.
And it wasn't out of the realm of possibility. We negotiated a little bit. It went a little bit lower than what I originally proposed. It was still comfortable for me. It was comfortable for him because he had a budget himself. And he respected that in order to get the product at the high level that he wanted it, he needed to pay me a certain amount of money to get that product. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that is an important part of an ideal relationship, because it's not just the respect that I know what I'm doing, it's also the respect for me as a person trying to make a living, or to make not even make a living, but to exchange my services at a rate that is reasonable for that service. Because I think there's a lot of times where, you know, if somebody thinks that you can just do it in 2 hours, you know, like make a drawing in 2 hours, well, then that doesn't mean that it costs that much either, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's just, you know, you push the button and you say, computer, make this so.
And that's a really good point, because I had this discussion recently at my firm with a few colleagues of mine, where we all agreed that when a client, at least in architecture, when you're in construction and they see a contractor out there building something, it's tangible. They see it. They see the process, right? But when it's us and it's design, All they see are the products we present them at each meeting.
Sure.
And those products might look like they were easy, but if they actually understood what it took to get our education in there, right, and what it took to learn the program that we're using to do that, and how much experience it takes to be able to do it in that amount of time,
sure,
now they would understand the equivalency of the price equation, how the price equates to the amount of time that, yep, it took. So if you can bang that out in 2 hours, that might be a $10,000 thing, right? Like,
right,
in all reality, it could be. Yeah. And at the end of the day, it's like, how do we show that to our client? And how can we explain that to our client? And I think that's where it comes out to. It's a lot of communication back and forth. Like, to have a client that is open to communication, I think it is something that I want up there with respect. Like, yeah, I want the mutual respect, but I also want to be able to have someone who can listen and communicate well.
I think that one of the best business lessons that I was ever exposed to was, you can have something done well, something done cheap, or something done fast.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't have more than two of those three things.
Right.
Because if it's done well and done cheap, it's going to be expensive. Mm-hmm. Or if it's done well and it's done cheap, it can't be done fast. It's going, mm-hmm, to take time. Because you have to think through the problem, et cetera. And there's all those permutations of, mm-hmm, what the triangle could be. But it's important to maybe have those discussions with, and maybe not even have really that many discussions. I've just naturally encountered people who just get it,
mm-hmm,
you know, who just understand. And we're coming at this from the ideal client perspective. So, mm-hmm, I think there are certain people in the world who just acknowledge and respect the process.
Right.
And there are people in the world who just don't.
Mm-hmm.
And while you can bring some people around who don't respect the process, it's much more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
It takes much more time and money to actually make that happen. And it's not that they're bad people. It's just that they have either been educated to understand the process is one way when it's actually a completely different way.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I mean, maybe they don't care. Or maybe they would just rather save a dollar or two, but still get like the Rolls Royce of products, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's the problem. It's like there's this discrepancy in perception sometimes that, you know, and this feeds from sort of our free culture right now where, you know, take apps on, you know, the iTunes App Store or Google Store or whatever, free apps. You know, there's expectations that you're going to get stuff for free,
mm-hmm,
and you can just play it forever and it's free. And, you,
yeah,
know, I'm going to play Candy Crush forever. And,
yeah,
and or I'm going to get, in order to get something that, from a company that, you know, maybe you have to have a trial offer first, or,
mm-hmm,
because it's an expectation now that everything is at least at the base level free. Like, mm-hmm, nothing is costs anything anymore.
Right.
Except for, you know, maybe there's exceptions where, you know, big things like houses or cars or whatever might cost money. But even there, there's an expectation that you're going to negotiate so well that you're going to get it for like half off somehow, mm-hmm, which isn't, you know, it's not even a real expectation,
right,
for those things.
Yeah.
I think that keeping sort of expectations in check and trying to find the people that understand, whether it's a service or a product, that something happened that, you know, there's an embodied energy in that task or that object that somebody spent to make that happen.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like it's, I just like the example that you had so much, because it's not like somebody can literally push a button and say, computer, do this.
Yeah,
like,
right. It's not a Google search,
right,
you know, and I think it's because, And you know, honestly, an idea just popped into my head throughout this whole conversation. It's kind of an epiphany, actually, that we as designers also don't do a good job of explaining ourselves.
Sure.
And we're not trained to do that. You and I talk very well, but that's because we've been podcasting for so long now and we've been blogging. So, like, yeah, we have a way of talking now. But not everyone has that way of explaining themselves. And also, our websites, our portfolios, like, we don't actually say this is the process of design, this is the service we provide, right? When you go on any service-based website now, they all break down the steps in such an easy way of understanding. And I think that might be, actually be the missing piece. This is just like going off on a tangent, right. But every website is just, here's my beautiful work. You hire me, you're gonna get this beautiful work. But it doesn't break it down. There's no learn more about our process here, or a tab that says our process. And then when you click it, it's like a timeline of how things actually work,
right.
And a brief explanation of how those things operate. Because if you had that and a client actually wanted to hire you, most clients want to learn about your firm first. Yep. They would likely click that button and read through it and say, oh, this sounds like a firm for me.
Yep.
Right? If your process matched what they were looking for, they would hire you. So maybe in retrospect, we also need to do a better job of explaining the skills that we have, the skill set that we have, and the amount of time it takes to accomplish each task with a breakdown of, you know, if they want to learn more, they could click it with, you know, a drop down that says, this is how long it takes to design something. These are the programs we use, and this is how they operate and function. We need to use our knowledge and our skill set to be able to do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
Maybe it doesn't make sense, but if you're a graphic designer and you could design this graphic really well, it's worth selling to other designers.
Yeah, and I think the thing that I completely agree with everything you just said. The thing that I struggle with inherently is and I immediately think of recycling, and this will make sense to you in a second. When I think of recycling, things that can be recycled from, you know, waste that I have in my own household, things like that. I, as a person who respects the earth and respects the fact that global warming is a real thing, I believe in that. I believe that we have an obligation to make sure that the next generation, at the very least, doesn't have it worse than we do now.
Mm-hmm.
I really believe in recycling. Mm-hmm. As at least a small step that I can make as a human being to protect our investment as a global culture in the world and the earth to maintain it. I don't see myself as a tree hugger or anything like that. I see myself as somebody who, that's the least I can do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you could apply that mentality to what you just said, I feel like I can do that as, maybe explain my process better and try to really explain that to other people.
Right.
I feel like the problem that we have as designers, as a culture, is that so many other people aren't doing that. Mm-hmm. Like, not everybody recycles. Not everybody is responsible in terms of, I don't think everybody should necessarily have the stance that I just had.
Right.
But I feel like it's on the same level of, you know, some people know that they should do it, but they just don't.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when people don't show up at their website and they don't know why, I don't think people are necessarily looking at, okay, well, why don't I explain my process more?
Yeah.
Even though I completely agree with you, I feel like that would be the key for more people to say, to reach out to that person and say, I would like to work with you, because that's that process and how we would actually work together sounds awesome.
Yeah.
So I struggle with it a lot because that's the first thing that comes to mind. I think of it as like...
Well, I wasn't really implying like it would be a process of like, you know, in that example.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be a process explaining your views on sustainability. Instead, I think the process would literally be, how do you design and how does that tie into the potential client? And if you can bridge that gap in a very clear way, you know, like a bullet point or whatever, or like an icon that you designed, and then just a quick explanation that says something like, you know, our process starts with understanding what our clients need.
Sure.
And then you provide an example. And then you like break that down and you just keep on breaking it down.
And maybe just to clarify, I don't mean literally talking about sustainability.
Yeah.
I mean like... there are so many designers out there that are probably just putting out portfolios.
Right.
That it becomes this this overall sea of consistently not doing it the way you're talking about.
Right, exactly. And I think that's the issue. And we've had this discussion before.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That it's all about, take the prettiest picture, Mike, of your finished building. Like, photographers get in some crazy positions to take these pictures.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
Then it's like, okay, share this on a website. Right. Share it on social media. We're going to get followers. We're going to get whatever.
Yep.
But if you actually explain, like, what is it that you're about? What is it that your firm is about? What is it that your design is about? What is it that you stand for? You're going to find your niche. And I think that's the missing element here, that as a designer and as a design company, a lot of firms typically approach this from, these are our services. We can do this for everybody out there in the whole world, so hire us, no matter who you are. Just hire us, right? And it's like, no, maybe you don't do it for everybody. And yeah, maybe you're gonna starve a little bit in the beginning, but once you do it for the first person who loved this area that you niched into, is going to know someone else who loves that area that you niched into.
Sure.
Like the Bugatti Club. Everyone who owns a Bugatti is in the same club,
right?
If you know one owner and you did something for that one owner and you guys had this love for a Bugatti, you're all gonna have, you're gonna have ties to the next guy. Same with Lamborghinis, right? And it's like, I'm not saying you have to say my process is geared around Bugatti owners, but like if you had this idea for sustainability and how recycled materials can be utilized in the process of architecture, because you're now designing a house that follows the whole idea of a living building, right?
Sure.
That you're going beyond LEED and you don't want LEED Platinum. You're going for a living building that generates more energy than it uses and it doesn't have any waste and everything is compostable, right? And you explain the reasons why from your own perspective and you put you as a designer into that, it teaches the client something about you.
Sure.
Eventually, you'll find an ideal client. Now, if you niche too far in, and there's only one guy out there because you want to design, you know, the first building on Mars that's inhabitable, and like there's only five people and it's like NASA, Tesla, or SpaceX, and whoever, like you might get them, but the chances of that versus someone else getting them is different.
I think maybe another way to get the, so the company that I work for, it's a firm in Buffalo, and one of their branding tactics is to, I don't think they necessarily use it in this specific way anymore, but when I started, everybody got their caricature done. So I have a caricature done of me that's like an official sort of like...
I just saw it yesterday, actually.
Firm promotion material, right?
Right.
And the idea is that the company works with school districts to renovate schools, to build additions on schools, to build new schools in the Western New York, Buffalo area, right? And I think that in some ways it's more effective as a tool to promote it that way, because the vibe that comes from the company itself is that it's very, you know, warm feelings, very sort of fun going,
playful.
Playful is a great word. And that's the vibe. There's more like a feeling of, that you emote to get the same kinds of people on the other end interested in working with you.
Yeah, but it also sets you guys apart. It made you guys memorable, because we talked about that yesterday at my firm.
Yeah.
Because we did some, one person here had this great idea, right? And what he did was he purchased custom Lego pieces of each person at the firm.
Oh my
and
gosh.
Slowly over a period of a few months, placed them when no one was around on everyone's desk, one by one. Every day it would appear on someone's desk. And these little characters looked like us, and we're like, oh, we should use this as a marketing opportunity, right?
Sure.
Well, then we were like, oh, at your firm, and we know your firm because we're all local.
Yeah.
We're like, one of them said, you know, they do caricatures there.
Right.
And like it stood out. Like that's what they remembered about your firm.
Yeah.
So if it stood out to us, imagine what it did for someone else.
Sure.
Right. And so it added character. It added something different. It added like this level of what sets you guys apart. And it wasn't a service. It was just an idea. And
yeah.
It was like, wow, they're creative, right? Like you guys got caricatures done.
Yeah.
So
I mean, I think that it, in the same way where we talk about niching down into a very specific group to find that ideal client for what we're looking for, right? It can, I think people sometimes are scared of that because it actually does deflect other people.
Yeah.
So like I would imagine that there are certain people who are like, oh my God, there's caricatures on their website. Like, that's ridiculous. I don't want to work with them.
Yeah.
But it almost deflects the people that you wouldn't necessarily want to work with anyway.
Right.
Because they're a different type of person. They're not a bad person. It's just that they're a different type of like they have a different mentality.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's the vibe you're creating in your promotional, your branding materials, whatever, it helps set you apart, but it also sets you apart in a way that is probably protecting you from creating these negative relationships that we've already kind of alluded to.
Right.
You know, it's like a way to sort of weed out the people that you wouldn't necessarily want to work with anyway, because they're just not your people.
Right.
Like, it's kind of the way I think about it when I think of the ideal client that I would want to work with is, are they my people? Are they the people that I would be able to work well with because of, not necessarily that we share I don't even think of it as necessarily sharing all the same values. I might have completely political differences with somebody. I might have completely different ideas of what, I don't know, something maybe even silly, like what is the best flavor ice cream? Like,
yeah.
There are certain things that matter, certain things that don't.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to all work harmoniously. It just needs to work at a professional level. What are the things that are important? And I think we've gone over a lot of them already. But as long as you can get the vibe and the feeling to sort of work well and the practical functions of the business relationship are there, like being able to pay somebody or being able to make decisions and make the project successful, I feel like that's really what I would look for in an ideal client.
Yeah, and I think the last thing that I'll end this episode on is just that when I think about everything we talked about today, one of the things in retrospect that I think a lot of firms do wrong from the beginning is that we design our website and our marketing and our brochures around what other people are doing and have done.
Yep.
And we never think about it from the client backwards, right? So when you think of who your ideal client is and you work back from there and you think of it as, how do I talk to that person?
Absolutely.
I think you can design your website a lot better, your brochures a lot better, your marketing materials better, and you could also start niching down on LinkedIn and reaching out immediately, because now you know the types of people you're looking for, the kind of clients you're looking for, and then it becomes a relationship, like you said. And I think that's the most important thing. It's not that you want to have a random passerby stumble on you and say, hey, I really want you to work for me because I see beautiful pictures of your buildings.
Sure.
Instead, you want them to say, hey, I really love the fact that in your process, this is what you guys are all about.
Sure.
You believe in sustainability, you believe in net zero, you believe in whatever, and I believe the same thing. I know it's going to cost more, but I'd like to work with you to get it done.
Yep.
And when you develop that relationship and it worked out and your vision wasn't a lie to them and they understood it, when you're done, they're going to help you get the next guy because they're going to just be tooting you unless you did something terrible. But ultimately, if you did what your process said and they loved it, they're going to tell the next guy down the street. And then maybe that one person will tell others. And I'll end on a note that I read this morning in Tim Ferriss's book that I'm reading now. It just keeps coming up.
Yeah.
In 12 of the Titans, I forget who he was interviewing, but it might have been in a Seth Godin chapter where Seth Godin said, think of it as something where if you tell 10 of your closest friends about your idea and those friends never shared it, it's a failure of an idea and you should move on to the next one. But if those 10 people shared it, then you're in business. And that's kind of related to this, because if you're talking to a client who found you, or you're talking to 10 clients and all 10 of them shared your work, that might lead in 20 more people, then 40 more people, then 8, and it'll just keep doubling. And ultimately, that's what you're looking for with an ideal client, someone who's going to help you grow as well, because they believed in your vision, and then they're going to tell the next person about your process, not about your beautiful pictures. So that's all I got on this one today. Thank you guys for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to another episode of Unpacking Design. And you can check us out anytime at the unpackingdesign.com website.
And you can also find us on iTunes and anywhere else that you listen to podcasts. Please remember to leave a review and share this podcast with someone you know.